was going to be really hard to beat. I was thinking on the way here today that the last time I spoke in a United Church was in 1976. I gave a sermon at the United Church in Windsor. And the history or the background to that was that at that time I was teaching there in the law school at the University of Windsor. And myself and another chap, we organized a boycott of the Toronto Dominion Bank on campus because they were one of three Canadian banks that were providing a massive loan to the government of Chile, run then by a man called Pinochet, who I'm sure you've all heard of. It was a successful escapade, if I can call it that. We had about 40 people withdraw their accounts from the campus bank. And then I got a call from the Reverend Paul of the local United Church, not this Paul, and you're too young. Oh, he's not there, but wherever he is, he's too young. And he was annoyed that I had done this without consulting him. And he said, can we do the same thing in downtown Windsor? And I said, of course. So we went and did all three banks in downtown Windsor. It was the TD, the Bank of Commerce, and the Royal Bank, as I recall. And we visited each of them and made our sentiments known about them loaning money to such an awful and torturing government. And then Reverend Paul asked me to give the sermon that Sunday at his church. And I did, and my best memory of it is the Reverend Paul coming in, leading the choir down the aisle, up here, so to speak. And instead of carrying the cross, he was carrying his banner from the demonstration that had happened 4 days before, saying, Canadian banks don't loan money to Chile, or words to that effect. So that was in my my radical days, although I'm not sure I'm any less radical now than I was then. You know, few would argue, and I'm not sure anyone would argue overtly, with the proposition that the uncovering of wrongful convictions that have already occurred and the prevention of ones that may occur in the future is really an issue of human rights. You only have to look at Dynash to see how it is an issue of human rights. And the day before an election, which it is, that's important because it should be a non-partisan issue, the protection of those who may be wrongly convicted in the future and the uncovering of cases of those who already have been. Dynash has told you quite a bit about his case. And the real features of his case were that he'd just been in Canada for a year or less than a year. He had a one-year-old son, Sarab, who was apprehended by Children's Aid as soon as he was charged with murder. He didn't tell you he was charged with murder, but he was. He was charged with murder of his 5-week-old baby, Garov. He was a very recent landed immigrant, and as a consequence was facing deportation if convicted, and was facing a life sentence for murder, and could barely speak English. So in those circumstances, when 6 months after being charged, on December 3rd of 1992, he was offered a plea by the Crown Attorney, he took it. And it's very obvious why. He was offered a plea to criminal negligence causing death and will withdraw the murder. We'll agree that you'll get a sentence of 90 days weekends in prison. So you go in Friday night, you get out Monday morning until you serve 90 days. We will not report your case to immigration. And Children's Aid have assured us that within 6 months, Sarab will be returned to you and your family. As the Court of Appeal put it in 2011, after serving his sentence, Dinesh always felt the shame of having to admit to causing Gaurav's death. He and his wife decided not to have another child, and they think about Gaurav every day. While his wife and Saurabh, his son, became Canadian citizens, Dinesh himself never applied for citizenship for fear that his conviction could lead to an immigration investigation. So it wasn't until 2007 that it came to be known that he had been convicted of a crime that never happened. His case was reviewed by a panel that I was on and others, including the chief pathologist for the province, a man called Dr. Michael Palanan. And it was discovered that the cause of death was almost certainly as a result of Gaurav's birth. Unbeknownst to anyone at birth, he had suffered a severe subdural hemorrhage. Not an infrequant occurrence, and it was observed to still exist at the time of autopsy. And the cause of his death was likely 5 weeks later, a rebleed, as they call it, of that very same subdural hemorrhage. So in January of 2011, we asked the Court of Appeal to allow Dinesh a 16-year extension of time to appeal his conviction. They allowed it. That avoided the ministerial review process I'll be telling you about in a moment. And as Dinesh told you, later that year, the Court of Appeal gave judgment acquitting him, or as Dinesh puts it, and it's a good word, exonerating him in the death of his child. As the Court of Appeal said at the time, and I quote, "The circumstances of Mr. Kumar's case are compelling. At the time he pleaded guilty, he was facing a charge of second-degree murder. He was new to Canada and was unfamiliar with the language and the legal system. At the time of Gaurav's death, his wife had just returned from hospital after major surgery for a brain tumor. He was facing loss of his liberty for at least 10 years, loss of custody of his remaining child, and deportation. The justice system now held out a powerful inducement, a reduced charge, a much reduced sentence, all but the elimination of the possibility of deportation and custody of his surviving child. This is, of course, a proper side to set aside his guilty plea to avoid a continuing miscarriage of justice. There was no evidence to support a finding that Mr. Kumar was responsible for his child's death, and the medical evidence shows that this was not a homicide. What it does show, the evidence, is that Mr. Kumar was a loving parent who pleaded guilty because of the enormous stress he was under at the time. As his counsel put it, the pressure proved to be too much." And he told you the story about how he went straight to his temple and he posted on the notice board the article, I don't think he told you this, the article from the Toronto Star in which his story of exoneration was in the story, in the newspaper. And the Toronto Star knew this was coming, that this was the one thing Dinesh always planned to do. So the next day, there was a story in the Star of the Star being on the notice board at the temple, and a picture of Dinesh standing beside it with a big grin on his face. So it came to a happy ending in a sense, but what a long time to wait, 15 years for a happy ending. But he and his wife and Saurabh are doing well, as you can see. Saurabh is now at college, and you can see why when I was asked who I wanted to introduce me, I chose Dinesh, because he's such a kind, gentle, and wonderful man. So, how is our system when it comes to uncovering wrongful convictions and preventing them? Let's talk about uncovering them for a moment. And tomorrow is not entirely irrelevant to uncovering them. Because as things stand, we have a very antiquated system of reviewing wrongful convictions in Canada. If you've exhausted all your appeals, and Dinesh fortunately had not, he'd never appealed, so we were able to appeal some 16 years later. But if you have gone through all your appeals, then what we are left with as a system of review is a system that dates back to 19th century English law of bringing an application to the Minister of Justice in Ottawa to review your conviction on an allegation that it's a wrongful conviction. I think simply to say it, you can probably all appreciate what an unfair, unjust, and really rather unfortunate system that is. The British got rid of it in 1997 and created an independent tribunal to review claims of wrongful conviction. And that tribunal has the power to refer cases back to the Court of Appeal for re-review. It's been a very successful system. In the period since 1997, what's called in the UK the Criminal Cases Review Commission has referred some 807 cases back to the Court of Appeal for review. And more than 75% of those referrals have resulted in either a quashing of a conviction or a lessening of a sentence. In that same period of time, our justice minister system, where the justice minister has the same power that that commission in the UK has to refer cases back to the courts, we've had 27 referrals. 27 besides 807. It's not hard to see we've got huge problems in our system of redress for those who are wrongly convicted and always have. The British came to realize the hopeless inadequacy of their system, which was the same as ours. Substitute the Home Secretary for the Justice Minister, and you had an identical system that they had. And then they realized how their Home Secretary system had messed up time after time after time for a series of Irish people, men, women, and children, who had been wrongly convicted of bombing, of being involved in bombing campaigns in England in the period of the 1960s and early 1970s. They were all multiples, or many of them were. You probably heard of some of them. The Birmingham Six, the Guildford Four, the Maguire Seven. You got 17 wrongful convictions right there. And yet the Home Secretary system, time after time, had failed them. Our system, besides being run by a politician, who is not the right person to decide whether someone is wrongly convicted, particularly the politician who runs the very system that's caused the wrongful conviction in the first place, also operates, it's been compared to being like a snail with arthritis. It operates unbelievably slowly. And just last week, myself and two wrongly convicted people, one who will certainly be known to you, and the other maybe, David Milgaard, spent 23 years in jail for a murder he didn't commit in Saskatoon, and Ron Dalton, who spent 8 years in prison for the murder of his wife, a crime not unlike Dinesh's that never actually happened. Beside me, or I was beside them, perhaps a better way of putting it, we did a press conference advocating for an independent tribunal. And the reason we did it is because three of the political parties have actually, for the first time in history, in Canadian history, adopted the idea of creating an independent tribunal through legislation in Canada, the Liberals, the NDP, and the Greens. We have asked as well the Conservatives and the Bloc to come on side, but to date, neither of them have. We see this as a nonpartisan issue. And regardless of who wins or draws or whatever coalition wins tomorrow, we will, of course, keep pushing for it. Because that is how you uncover wrongful convictions. You have an independent tribunal to review applications. Then you don't have to do somersaults like in Dinesh's case to ask a court to extend a time to appeal by 16 years. One case we did to avoid the ministerial review process, we went to the Supreme Court of Canada and asked them to give us a 40-year extension to file an appeal. And God bless them, they gave it to us because he'd never appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada. But if we had a decent tribunal system, you wouldn't have to go through these kinds of things to try and get a review. Now, what about preventing wrongful convictions? Well, again, with an election tomorrow, one of the things that always scares those of us who are involved in the wrongful conviction movement, really around the world, is law and order governments. Law and order governments are never good for the criminal justice system, especially for the indigenous and for visible minorities. They are such easy targets. One of the things we don't have in Canada that is a major cause, a major contributing cause to wrongful convictions south of the border, is the death penalty. And hopefully we never will have a death penalty come back. We hope that it will always be considered unconstitutional as cruel and unusual punishment. And since the 1950s, we've been very lucky when it comes to the death penalty. We've had a whole series of prime ministers who have themselves opposed it, starting with John Diefenbaker, who was opposed to the death penalty. Lester Pearson, Pierre Trudeau, Joe Clark, so it crosses conservative and liberal boundaries. John Turner, Brian Mulroney, Kim Campbell, Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, the only exception then being Stephen Harper, who did support the death penalty publicly, and indeed refused to assist a Canadian who was sitting on death row in Montana, had been there then for more than 25 years, refused to assist him despite an assurance from Montana that if the Canadian government came on side, they would send him back to Canada and let him off death row. Today's candidates, we know Justin Trudeau, certainly Jagmeet Singh. I don't know for sure the Bloc, but certainly in the past, the Bloc has always opposed the death penalty. And I don't know Mr. Scheer's position, but hopefully he opposes the death penalty as well. It's an important issue for wrongful convictions because, as I said, it's a cause of wrongful convictions. You bring the death penalty into the process and it just raises the odds. That's the problem. And once you raise the odds, then you raise the likelihood of misconduct by the parties involved in the process. In 2001, the Supreme Court of Canada, when it held that Canada would no longer extradite Canadians to a country where they could face the death penalty, the Supreme Court of Canada, in a unanimous judgment, said in its opening paragraph, "Legal systems have to live with the possibility of error. The unique feature of capital punishment is that it puts beyond recall the possibility of correction. In recent years, aided by advances in the forensic sciences, including DNA, the courts and governments in this country and elsewhere have come to acknowledge a number of instances of wrongful convictions for murder. If capital punishment had been carried out, the result could have been the killing by the government of innocent individuals. The names of Donald Marshall, David Milgar, Guy Paul Moran, Thomas Sofano, and Greg Parsons signal prudence and caution in a murder case. How do we prevent them in Canada in terms of our laws? That's something that I think would really take too long to talk about, but a better way of talking about it in a setting like this is to try and talk about some of their causes. Because if you talk about their causes, then you've taken a giant step towards working out how you might prevent them in the future. And the first thing to realize is that the criminal justice system is a very human system. There's a lot of humans involved from beginning to end. And human beings make mistakes, whether unintended mistakes or acting on something that is in fact false without realizing it. That means that the system is fallible. That means there are always going to be mistakes. That doesn't mean we've got a rotten system. It means it's just a recognition that nothing in this world is perfect. And believe me, the criminal justice system is not perfect. In the case of a man called Mahmoud Matan, hanged on September the 8th of 1952 in Cardiff, Wales, for a robbery murder he did not commit, some 46 years later, after the Criminal Cases Review Commission had referred his case back to the Court of Appeal, I might add, the Home Secretary system having turned him down three times before that, the Court of Appeal, in quashing Mr. Matan's conviction, had this to say. It is, of course, a matter of very profound regret that in 1952, Mahmoud Matan was convicted and hanged, and it's taken 46 years for that conviction to be shown to be a wrongful conviction. His case demonstrates that capital punishment was not perhaps a prudent culmination for a criminal justice system which is human and therefore fallible. And indeed, of course, it is fallible. Just take Dinesh's case. When someone dies and there's a suspected homicide, or the cause of death is uncertain, then the first person likely to have to make an essential decision is the pathologist. And the pathologist can get it wrong. Charles Smith got a lot of cases wrong. And he's not the only pathologist in Canada who's been found to have got a case wrong. Indeed, Ronald Dalton, who I sat next to last week at the press conference, who is now the co-president of Innocence Canada, was convicted of murdering his wife on the basis of bad pathology. The pathologist at the time in Newfoundland came to the conclusion that his wife had died as a result of manual strangulation. And if she had, then undoubtedly Ron Dalton had killed her because he was the only person with her when she died. In fact, it turned out that all the signs supposedly consistent with manual strangulation were in fact caused by the medics when they came to try and save her life. And in fact, she had died as a result of choking on cereal that she was eating at the time. And Ronald Dalton spent 8 years in jail for something he didn't do. And he's a good example of how, whilst most wrongful convictions are going to happen to the indigent, to the indigenous, to visible minorities, they can actually happen to anyone. And Ron Dalton, of all things, was a bank manager at the time of his arrest, conviction, and the 8 years he spent in jail. The second thing that can quickly go wrong is the police investigation. The police investigation can easily engage in what I call a rush to judgment. or even in some cases, a very vivid phrase actually propounded by a police officer, a senior police officer, they can engage in noble cause corruption, a phrase which kind of speaks for itself. It may come early, it may come later. In Guy Paul Morand's case, it came later. Christine Jessop disappeared on October 3rd of 1984. Her body was found on December 31st of 1984. By April of 1985, the police investigation was going nowhere. They had no suspects. They had never had any suspects. And then in April, they happened to run into Guy Paul Morand, who was one of Christine Jessop's neighbors. A young man, he was 20, 21 at the time. And they thought he was odd. And being odd was enough for them. He wasn't odd. He's actually a delightful man with a fantastic sense of humor. But they thought, they interpreted that as him being odd. And suddenly their investigation focused on him. And literally their minds created evidence against him, resulting in his eventual wrongful conviction for the murder of Christine Jessop, an 8-year-old girl. And it wasn't until 1995, some 10 years later, that DNA taken from Christine Jessop's panties that had been found where her body was found established that there was one person in the world who had not raped and murdered Christine Jessop. It was Guy Paul Morand. As you move along, it can be forensics. Forensic science is a well-known cause of wrongful convictions. Ironically, it's also a well-known cause of writing a wrongful conviction. Take Guy Paul Morand's case as an example. But bad science or a bad scientist, Dinesh Kumar, can lead to a wrongful conviction. And again, we know it can happen to anyone. One of the most or more remarkable cases that we're dealing with at Innocence Canada is the case of a man convicted of first-degree murder. He's now 84 years old. He's been in prison in the penitentiary for the last 7 years. And he, in his previous life, if I can put it that way, had been a judge in the Quebec courts for 23 years. A Superior Court judge for 10 of them, and a Court of Appeal judge for 13 years, up until his retirement. Then arrested and charged with his wife's murder. It's an obvious wrongful conviction, but oddly enough, and perhaps ironically, his status is his biggest problem, because the Quebec justice system does not want to acknowledge what a ghastly mistake they made in his case. And the mistake is a mistake that arises out of forensic science. If I can just show you very quickly an aspect of his case, or the aspect of his case, and I'm going to show you a couple of pictures of the deceased where she was shot in the head. Does anyone mind if I do? Please, one hand up is enough to stop me. You'd rather I didn't? No, I've got someone who'd rather I didn't, so that's fair enough. Let me tell you this. His wife was found. I can show you where she was found. Oops, sorry. His wife was found on the couch in their condo in Quebec City, and this would have been in 2008. She was shot. She had a bullet hole in her left temple. The bullet had entered her head and had killed her. She was found by her husband, Jacques Delisle. If I can flick through two pictures, this, you're now looking at the problem. That is the hand of his wife. And as you can see, there is a significant mark consistent only with gunshot residue on the lower part of the palm of her left hand, what's called the hypothenar eminence of her hand. I'd never heard that expression before, but that's apparently what it's called, the hypothenar eminence of her hand. And the forensic scientists who looked at the case in Montreal, the pathologist and a firearms expert, said to themselves, how on earth could she have got that on her hand if she had shot herself? Now, Mrs. Ranville, that was her name, Jack DeLeo's wife, Nicole Ranville, had had a stroke 3 years before, been very depressed since, told a lot of people that she wanted to die, and was paralyzed on her right side, completely paralyzed, unable to move her arm, her hand, or anything on her right side. So she must have shot herself, if indeed she did, using only her left hand. So the pathologists and the firearms experts said, well, and this is a toy gun, believe me, if you shoot yourself in the temple as she was shot, there's no chance that you're going to get gunshot residue on the lower part of your palm because the gunshot residue goes forwards out of the muzzle of the gun. And they were quite right. That is quite true, of course. So then they set about hypothesizing how she could have got the gunshot residue there in a manner that was consistent with homicide. I don't think they even necessarily realized that's what they were doing, but that's what they did. And they came up with a homicide theory. And the theory was she was shot by a third party, which would really have to be her husband. No one else was in the condo at any time, and he wasn't in the condo when she died, but he's the one who found her. So their theory was that a third party, her husband, had shot her, and she had put her hand up against the gun, causing the gunshot residue as it came out of the muzzle to collect at the foot of her palm. What they didn't say to themselves was, well, is there a theory consistent with suicide that can explain the gunshot residue? And the answer is, of course there is, so long as you consider how she might have held the gun. And a perfectly logical way that she might have held the gun, bearing in mind she's only got one arm, one hand, is she could have nestled it in her hand, her left hand, in a way that would most likely avoid recoil, put it to her temple, and pull the trigger. And the muzzle then is right where the powder burns are on her hand. But they didn't think of that because that wasn't their way of thinking at the time of the autopsy. And we now have that case in the minister's office on the basis that new pathology evidence has established that Nicole Ranville committed suicide and that Jacques Delisle is in prison for a crime that never happened. And the sad thing about it is his eligibility for parole, it's a way of really making the point. He is eligible for parole when he's 102 years old. Stephen Truscott as well was very much a victim of forensic science. He was a victim of many things, but in particular, a victim of forensic science. Not coming up on the main screen. I'll see if it comes up. I'm sure many of you are familiar, if not all of you are familiar, with the case of Stephen Truscott. Stephen, a 14-year-old boy, was convicted of the rape murder of a 12-year-old girl called Lynn Harper. Lynn disappeared on Tuesday, June 9, 1959, on a nice sunny evening. Her body was found on Thursday afternoon, June 11th, 2 days later. And at the autopsy, the pathologist, a man called Dr. Peniston, found the remains of her last meal in her stomach. It was quickly determined that she'd eaten her last meal at 6 p.m. on the evening she disappeared, Tuesday. She'd eaten it at her parents' home. She had been seen with Stephen Truscott as late as 7:45, 7:50 that evening. She had been on the crossbar of his bike. Stephen told the police that he had dropped her off at the highway because she wanted to go and see some horses in a field. And then he had turned around and cycled back to the airbase where he and Lynn and her parents and his parents lived. Her body was found halfway between the airbase and where Stephen said he had dropped her off, in a small bunch of bushes known as Lawson's Bush, named after the farmer who owned the field, Farmer Lawson. And an autopsy, Dr. Peniston, who did the autopsy, determined that the stomach contents that he was looking at, she must have eaten her last meal within 2 hours of having eaten it. This meant she must have died by 8 o'clock in the evening at the latest, which meant, effectively, that Stephen Truscott must have killed her. This had all happened. Remember, it's in June, so it was a sunny, bright evening. There were lots of people up and down the road. It's not conceivable he could have dropped her off. Someone else could have picked her up and killed her in a 5-10 minute period of time. As the prosecutor put it in his closing address to the jury, now we come to apply the opinion of time of death. And I suggest to you, gentlemen of the jury, in those days it was all men, 12 men, it is awfully important when this girl died. Now, who was with her during this time? What person or persons had the opportunity to kill her between 7 and 8 p.m.? I suggest that a review of the facts narrows those facts like a vice on Stephen Truscott and no one else. In 1966, a woman called Isabel Le Bourdais wrote a book about the case. It was quite a notorious book at the time. No one before then in Canada had ever tried to suggest a court, it's hard to believe now, but it was true then, that a criminal court, could have got it wrong. And indeed, in the archives, when we came onto the case in the late 90s, early 2000s, we found a letter from the trial judge to the then Minister of Justice in 1966, Jean Chrétien, of all people. And the trial judge demanded that the author of the book, Isabel Le Bourdais, be prosecuted for public mischief because the book was full of lies. Just an interesting historical point. But it led the book to the Supreme Court of Canada reviewing the case. And in 1967, it did so. And it heard from pathologists on both sides, half of them saying that a 2 hour time of death was a correct window, and half saying it wasn't. And the Supreme Court of Canada ultimately said, we really don't know. We've got an even set of opinions on each side, so we're going to uphold the conviction. It wasn't until 1997 that Stephen Truscott came to us and asked us to look at his case. And we went into the archives and we found a letter that Dr. Peniston had written to the officer in charge in 1966, 67, just before the reference in the Supreme Court of Canada, in which he had completely revised the opinion that he had given at trial. Something that had never been disclosed to Stephen Truscott's counsel in 1966, 1967. And when the case was eventually heard by the Court of Appeal of this province in 2007, when they finally exonerated and acquitted Stephen Truscott, they put the contents of a letter into their judgment. And this is what Peniston had written all those years before. "In my review of this case," he writes to the investigating officer, "I have tried to clarify the facts as set out in the post-mortem report on Lynn Harper and to restate the conclusions drawn from them and expressed in those places. I don't believe I have changed any of my essential conclusions as a result of my review." One is tempted to refer to this letter as an agonizing reappraisal in the current jargon. The adjective is probably better justified here than in most cases, but I must depend on someone else to assess whether there's any significant change in the expression of these views. That Lynn Harper died any time within 12 hours of her last meal. Talk of an agonizing reappraisal. It was a complete change in his evidence. And yet, it was never disclosed. So there, we have an example not just of, I'm not sure if you call that, what kind of pathology you call that, but certainly bad pathology, let's call it that, at a most general level. But it also means we had the next cause of wrongful convictions, a prosecutor who did not play by the rules, who did not disclose essential information to Stephen Truscott's counsel in 1967, as a result of which it was another 40 years before Stephen Truscott was finally exonerated in the Court of Appeal. One of our more recent cases at Innocence Canada is a case of a Crown who didn't play by the rules. The case of a man called Frank Ostrowski, convicted in Winnipeg, Manitoba on April 17th of 1987 for a murder, where the evidence against him was dependent on a single witness called Matthew Lovelace. Matthew Lovelace, at the time of going to the police and incriminating Frank Ostrowski, and at the time of his evidence, which he gave at the murder trial, was facing a very serious cocaine charge. And the prosecutor and the witness himself, Lovelace, swore up and down that there'd be no agreement or no consideration given to him for his outstanding cocaine charge in exchange for the giving of evidence and the giving of his original statement as well against Frank Ostrowski. Frank Ostrowski came to us and we investigated the case. And we managed to find a document in a Crown file related to the witness Lovelace, in which there was a handwritten document dated the time that Lovelace gave his statement, in which a Crown attorney had handwritten the following, and I'll always be able to quote this to my deathbed: "If Lovelace comes through with the goodies, then we'll withdraw." There it was in black and white. And finally, on November the 27th of last year, 2018, some 31 years after his wrongful conviction, the Manitoba Court of Appeal quashed it and entered an acquittal. So a Crown who doesn't play by the rules. And indeed, the Crown in that case is a Crown who has been, or was the Crown, on four different cases now that we at Innocence Canada have exposed as wrongful convictions. One Crown, four wrongful convictions, a man called George Dangerfield. Another, perhaps not surprising, cause of wrongful convictions is an incompetent defense lawyer. As in any profession, we have incompetence in our profession too. Just as you do in all of your professions, there are incompetent people in your professions as well, whatever they may be. In criminal law, appeal courts actually are rather polite. They don't talk about incompetent defense lawyers. They talk about the ineffective assistance of defense lawyers is the rather sweet, gentle phrase applied to incompetent defense lawyers. And certainly a number of cases that we have worked on have had a cause, or the cause being an incompetent defense counsel. And then, of course, as you go through all the characters in the system, you have to consider the witnesses themselves. A witness may lie for whatever motive, usually, obviously, for personal motivations. Very often, the Crown will use what we call, again, a rather cute phrase that we use in the criminal justice system. They will use unsavory witnesses, which means incorrigible liars, is another way of putting it. But it's not just they who will be the cause of wrongful convictions, but sometimes witnesses will make honest mistakes. And this is particularly true when it comes to eyewitness identification. Erroneous eyewitness identification is a very well-known cause of wrongful convictions. In the US, the Innocence Project now has got their number up to somewhere around 350 post-conviction DNA exonerations. And the beauty of a DNA exoneration is it's not just they've shown that a conviction is unsafe, they've actually shown that the supposed perpetrator did not commit the crime because the DNA excludes him or her from having committed the crime. So they've been able to do and have done postmortems, so to speak, kind of an apt phrase or an apt term, for their cases to see what went wrong. Why was this man or woman convicted of a crime he or she did not commit when we now know that he or she did not commit it? And they found that in more than 80% of their cases, erroneous eyewitness identification played a role in the wrongful conviction. Not necessarily the only role, and indeed in many of them, not the only role. Because it won't surprise you to hear that a substantial cause of wrongful convictions in the US is racism. A very substantial cause is racism. And very often, that racism is tied up in erroneous eyewitness identification, to which the racism contributes in the first place. I thought I'd tell you about, if I may, it's in another 5 minutes, tell you about a case of erroneous eyewitness identification that took place in Toronto a few years ago. It's the case of a man called Anthony Hannemeyer. And it's kind of a pretty extraordinary case. On September the 29th of 1987, a mother and a single mom and her 15-year-old daughter were sleeping in their home at 5 in the morning when an intruder broke into the house in Scarborough, just south of Kingston Road, and attacked the 15-year-old daughter. The man jumped on her on the bed. He had a knife in hand and was about to rape her. The mum heard a noise, didn't know what it was, so she went into the room, into her daughter's bedroom, to see if everything was all right, to see this horrifying sight of a man on her daughter, knife in hand. She screamed, the man jumped up and fled out of the house, out of the back door. The mother had an idea as to who the perpetrator was. Of course, she called the police. The police got involved. And she thought the perpetrator might be from a work group, a group of working people who were working on her road at the time. She lived in a cul-de-sac, and there were people working at the end of a street. And she thought perhaps it was one of them who had noticed a vulnerable household, just herself as a single mother, and her 15-year-old daughter and attacked for that reason. And she contacted the workplace and they told her that indeed there was a man who worked with them of the approximate age, 20-21, of the man she'd seen in her daughter's bedroom, blondish hair. They had a worker who matched that description very well, and about the same height, 5'9", 5'10". So the police prepared, when she told them this, a photo lineup that contained a picture of this man, Anthony Hanemeyer. And she picked out his photograph from the photo lineup. The photo lineup was not recorded, so we don't know really what happened at that photo lineup. It's problematic because the officer in charge started dating the woman and ultimately they became married. So quite what happened at the photo lineup, whether there was any telegraphing, likely subconscious telegraphing that took place, we'll never know because it wasn't videotaped as it should have been. Suffice to say that on December the 18th of 1987, Anthony Hanemeyer was charged with break and enter with intent to commit a sexual assault. His trial began October 17th of 1989, and the second day of his trial, downtown Toronto, he decided to plead guilty on the advice of his lawyer because the mother had testified and his lawyer had found her to be such a convincing witness that he had told Anthony, you're going to get convicted. And if you're convicted, this is such a serious crime, any judge is likely to give you anything between 8 and 10 years. But the Crown's told me, and back to Dinesh Kumar, if you plead guilty, you'll agree to a sentence of 2 years less a day. Armed with that information, Anthony Hanemeyer pleaded guilty, got his 2 years less a day, and served it. In October of 2005, Paul Bernardo's lawyer contacted the police to tell them that Paul Bernardo wanted to confess to crimes he'd never been charged with on the basis that it might help him get parole at a later date because it would show what a contrite man he was. No comment. In April of 2006, the police went down to Kingston Penitentiary where he was doing his life sentence and interviewed him. And he told them of 5 or 6 crimes that he'd been charged with, that he'd never been charged with and never been questioned about. And one of them was a break-in to a woman's house where he had been about to assault a young girl in her bed and he was interrupted by someone coming into the room. And he fled. And the police were very quickly able to identify what he was talking about. Obviously, they had no idea about the crime that Anthony Hanemeyer had been convicted of. But they're able to identify it very quickly because Bernardo could remember the license plate of the car in the driveway of the mother because he actually went back and stole the license plate several months later. Why? Because the license plate was K-A-R-K-A-R, car for Carla, and that's why he stole it. So all the police had to do was look through Ministry of Transportation records to find out what case he was talking about and then realized, oh my God, someone had actually been convicted of the crime that Paul Bernardo had committed. Oddly enough, no one actually told Anthony Hanemeyer this had occurred. But fortunately, it came to our attention through another case that we were defending at the time, a man called Robert Baltovich, wrongly charged with the murder of his fiancée, in which we were suggesting that Paul Bernardo was in fact the likely killer of Robert Baltovich's fiancée. So the Crown had to disclose everything about him to us. And there it was, sitting amongst the material disclosed, his confession to this crime that someone else had committed. So we contacted Anthony Hanemeyer, and we ultimately got his case back into the Court of Appeal. And in August of 2008, the Court of Appeal said. This case represents an example of how flawed identification procedures can contribute to miscarriages of justice and the importance of taking great care in conducting those procedures. Mistaken eyewitness identification is the overwhelming factor leading to wrongful convictions. A study in the United States of DNA exonerations shows that mistaken eyewitness identification was a factor in over 80% of their cases. And of course, finally, as you move through the causes of wrongful conviction, there's the judge and the jury. We all come with our biases, whether we're judges or members of a jury. Take the recent case of Dean Blundell of Fan 590, who was on a jury of a man charged with sexual assault, and he was a gay man. And Dean Blundell was on the jury. And unbeknownst to anyone who was doing the case at the time, he was saying some quite viciously homophobic things on the radio on his show during and after the trial. Indeed, he declared after the trial on radio that he thought the day they convicted the man and he got 5 years in the penitentiary was probably the best day of his life. Can you imagine? That's what he said on public radio. And thank God the Court of Appeal quashed the conviction because of it. But you can see, I mean, it's not often that those things get exposed. What were the chances that you'd end up with a homophobe on a jury in such a case who would publicly make homophobic statements about the case that would happen to be heard by someone who would communicate it to the man who was convicted, because that's how it came about? Not high. Very low, in fact. And in fact, one of the things they often say about people who manage to expose their wrongful conviction is that they had luck. They had a lot of luck. Anthony Hanemeyer had a lot of luck. A lot of things went right for him before his wrongful conviction was shown to be just that. And finally, a feature of a wrongful conviction that's so important is that in many cases, not, I should say, Dinesh's case, of course, but in most cases of wrongful conviction, it means the wrong person is, not only is the wrong person being convicted, but the right person has not. And in, particularly in two of our cases that we have shown wrongful convictions, we have in the process shown who the real perpetrator of the crime was. The best known example of that is the case of David Milgaard. David Milgaard spent 23 years in prison before he was finally released by the Supreme Court of Canada in 1992. On the basis, said the Supreme Court of Canada, that there's a reasonable doubt as to whether he committed the crime. Not, you might say, much of an exoneration, to say the least. It wasn't an exoneration. It was a sort of, we're going to let you get away with it kind of judgment. Or if it wasn't intended to be that by the Supreme Court of Canada, that's how it was interpreted by many people afterwards. 5 years later, in 1997, we came up with DNA results. And the beauty of the DNA is not only did it show that the semen on Gail Miller's nurse's uniform was not David Milgaard's, so he was one person on this planet we knew had not killed Gail Miller, but the semen on her uniform came from Larry Fisher, who we were alleging had committed the crime, a man who had been committing serial rapes in Saskatoon, in Winnipeg, and ultimately in North Battleford, Saskatchewan, in the intervening 28 years. Larry Fisher was then arrested 5 days later, charged with the murder from 1969 of Gail Miller. As I say, we're now in 1997, was convicted of her murder in 1999, and died in prison just a couple of years ago. as the real murderer of Gail Miller. So do we need a Criminal Cases Review Commission to help us ascertain who was wrongly convicted? A properly financed tribunal, independent of government? Of course we do. But we don't just need it to exonerate the wrongly convicted, but we also need it, in some cases, to show who really did commit the crime. Thank you. I know it's a Sunday, and I know many of you are going to want to leave, but I have a video if you want to see it. It's 20 minutes long, of a man called Bill Mullins Johnson testifying in the Ontario Court of Appeal after spending 13 years in prison for a murder he did not commit. He's testifying in front of three judges, and it's a powerful testament for the wrongly convicted. It will bring tears to your eyes. I've seen it many times, and it always brings tears to my eyes. So I'm going to play it, and I won't be offended if people leave for obvious reasons, because it is a Sunday afternoon. So could you play it and perhaps cut the lights at the same time?